We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. Last July, the folks at Amazon announced that they had sold more electronic books than hardcovers. 6 months after that, they said that e-books had outsold paperbacks. And just last month, Amazon said electronic books were outselling hardcovers and paperbacks combined. Apple says, is that a them or isn't it it? Apple says that 130 million books have been downloaded now from their iBookstore. And there are some people who are saying, well, of course, all this means that 2011 will be the year of the e-book. E-books aren't really new, but it certainly seems that recently they have taken off. And we, this morning, want to talk a little bit about electronic books and what they mean for readers and writers and publishers. And we have two guests here with us in the studio. Philip Graham is professor of English at University of Illinois. He teaches creative writing, has published fiction, poetry, and nonfiction. He's been here before on the program, although not in a while. He used to stop by regularly. We would talk about books on the program. Also here with us in the studio is Martin Riker from the Dalkey Archive Press. This is a nonprofit that was founded in Chicago in the early 1980s, moved in 2006 to the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. It's a publisher that specializes in literary fiction and poetry, and a lot of their books are translations. So we thought it'd be interesting to have them here. They can approach this in a variety of ways, as readers certainly, to talk a little bit about the publishing industry, to talk about writing. And I would certainly welcome people who are listening to call in and tell us their experiences. You know, have you read something on a Kindle or an iPad? Do you embrace the idea? Do you resist? Oh, let's not leave Barnes and Noble out of the conversation. Yes. The Nooks, some sort of e-reader. I mean, have you had the experience? What do you think about it? Do you embrace it? Do you resist it? Any and all of that is certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. And email, oh yes, that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thank you both very much.
Great to be here.
Being here. Yeah. I think, Philip, are you a relatively recent convert to the e-book?
In the past, I have expressed a lot of skepticism about the e-book, really a lot. Full disclosure, my son works at Apple at the headquarters in Cupertino and was one of the team leaders on the iBook application. So I was inclined to give it a try when the iPad was launched, and when my son could finally tell me what he'd been secretly doing for the past year, I got my iPad, and I would have to say I pretty much fell in love with the e-book in a way that I did not expect to. Mm-hmm. Now, partly it's perhaps because some people say my iPad is my grandchild, but I don't think it's that at all. I actually think, and I think that this is only because the technology has gotten to the point where this could be true, but I actually think that in many ways an e-book is an improvement on the book. There are a lot of things that I can do with my e-book that I simply can't do with a paper book. I can make the font larger or smaller as I get older. That's great. I mean, you know, because in fact, I've got a pretty large font on the book I'm reading right now, but if I get older, I can pump that up, you know. At night, I can make the lighting on the front go down or up so I don't bother my wife if she's sleeping beside me in bed. I can do a search for – this is a great thing, especially, as I'm getting older. I'm on page 300 of a mystery novel, say, right? And then some obscure character comes up, Joe. I can't remember who Joe is. Now, did you ever do that when you look back and you fall?
Of course.
And it's a half an hour. You can't find Joe, right? Well, what you do here is in the search, you do Joe, and you press search. And Joe pops up immediately, embedded in the sentence that he appears in, the page number. You find it immediately, and you don't have any problem with that anymore, you know? If I have a word that comes up that I don't know, I just press the word. This is one of the things actually my son did. He pressed the word, and it immediately pops up a page, a small page, with a definition right out of the dictionary, and that's great. Now, a really wonderful thing that happened to me recently, I was reading a book by N.K. Narayan called Malgudi Days. It's about a bunch of villagers in a small town called Malgudi and their lives and so forth. And I was reading one story called The Green Blazer, and it was about a pickpocket. It was following a tourist with a green blazer, and he's about to pick the guy's pocket. And you get a little bit of the background, and he has been in trouble with pickpocketing in the past. His wife does not like what he has done in the past, and so he doesn't tell her that's what he's still doing. So whenever he comes back with some money, he tells her that it was a commission. Now, there was something about, and this is the thing I love about this, because you press any word and you get a dictionary, you know, definition and the origin and everything else, is that I spend a lot more time as a writer. I'm really interested in words. But also, as a writer, I'm kind of live a sedentary life, so I'm kind of lazy about if I'm in the living room walking to the study and going through the OED to look up the word I don't know. But I don't have that problem with an e-book. So I get to commission, and I figure, you know, I'd like to know a little bit more about that. So I pressed it. And I started going through the thing, and then I realized that one of the minor, you know, one of the later definitions of commission is commission of a crime. So, in fact, when this guy's going home and he's telling his wife the money is from a commission, he's actually telling her the truth, but he also knows that she doesn't think that's what he means. Now, I would have missed that if I'd been reading a regular book, because I wouldn't have looked up commission. And when I did that, when I go, wow, that's really cool. I really love what Narayan just did there. I'm feeling a little stupid that I couldn't have figured it out myself, but at least I got there. Never could have happened. Never could have had that experience with a paper book. Yeah. And I could go on and on and on about it and so forth. I love it.
And of course, you know? there are people who will do the same exercise, and they will tell you about all of the things that you can do with a book, with a paper book that you can. So I suppose there's going to be some trade off here. There are pluses and minuses.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let me. I want to turn here to Martin, and as someone who I'm sure is a reader, but also somebody who is in the publishing business. What have your experiences been with ebooks?
Well, just to comment a little bit on what Philip was just talking about, I don't have an e-reader. I haven't actually read an entire book in electronic form ever. But I don't have any problems with any of the things he just said. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think that the stigma of the ebook is has really changed over the last couple of years.
Oh, absolutely.
And to the point where a year or so ago I was talking with Michael Wood, who's a very famous highly literary critic who writes for the New York Review of Books and elsewhere, and he was saying almost exactly the same things you were saying about how beneficial he finds his e-reader.
Yeah. Well, I wonder whether this explosive growth in e-books partly is a fad, but partly also it was something that we were waiting to have a really practical e-reader. We now have several of them.
Sure.
A good piece of hardware that had to be there, and enough people had to use it and say, oh, okay, I see the advantages here and grow comfortable with it before the idea. Because there always have – because back for a long time now, there have been people who have been scanning books and making them available online.
Yeah,
right.
It's just that we didn't have a real good portable way to get a hold of it.
I would actually take that a step further and say that I think I've made the argument. I think it's true that the demand for e-readers was not driven by customers; it was driven by the industry.
Yeah.
That's not to say that any of the values that Philip just enumerated are in any way less true, but I think that it wasn't a demand created by people sitting around saying, if only I had a good e-reading device. You know, Amazon in particular sunk a lot of money into marketing the Kindle. And when they first came out with the Kindle, they were practically trying to give them away because they couldn't really get people interested. At this point, I would say that the division between e-books and paper books is a kind of a fake division. There is still a rhetoric of one versus the other. But I think that what we're going to see in the future is both. Certain texts definitely lend themselves to an electronic kind of reading. And then there are certainly readers who still want to read things in paper, and particularly the kinds of things that I publish, for instance, because I publish a lot of literary translations and literary works, which tend to be the ones that are least popular in ebook format. You cited those Amazon statistics, but the analysis of the statistics is that those statistics, one of the things that they reveal is the extent to which the vast majority of Amazon sales are for particularly small group of books. Mm. So bestsellers do really well in the ebook format. Whereas if you did an analysis by title of how many people are buying paper books versus ebooks, it would be a very different statistic.
Yeah. Well, I think that it is true that the things that have been most popular for ebooks have been genre fiction. They're mysteries, they're thrillers, they're books that you should, pardon the term, are kind of disposable. You read them, they're fun, that's great. You probably will never read them again. And that's the kind of thing that people are using. Philip has got his iPad here. He's showing me
60 books.
Bookshelf.
I got 60 books in my iBook, and I got 45 books or so in my Kindle app for my iPad. And you remember I used to come in here and talk about books, right? Uh-huh. And I would come in with two little sacks of books, right? You know, now I've got 100 books. I walked. It's still a pound. You know, I mean, it's wonderful. But I will though say about what you say about bestsellers and so forth. I don't actually think so. I'm finding more and more interesting books and small press books that are now available in ebooks. So, and I don't read bestsellers for the most part. So I was very skeptical from that sense of how many of my kind of books. But I'm going to do an ad for Dahlke and for Martin here. one of my very, very favorite books of the past couple of years is a novel by a Czech writer named Michael Ivaz, called The Golden Age. And I initially bought it in paperback. And liked it so much that over Christmas when my daughter-in-law came, I thought she would like it. I gave her my copy and I downloaded the iBook version. And then I loved the book so much that I'm now intending to buy a paperback so I can put it on my shelf. Because I think in a weird sort of way, I want the physical I love this book, and that's not going to happen very often. But if I find reading an ebook that I just completely adore it, I want a paper version.
Well, you're just not normal, Phil.
Yeah, I think I would make the same
argument. That.
I have several callers. We want to get people into the conversation here. Our guests this morning, Philip Graham and Martin Riker. Philip is professor of English and creative writing at University of Illinois, poet, novelist, writes a lot about writing. Martin Riker is the associate director at Dahlke Archive Press. It's based here at University of Illinois. Specializing in things that are of literary nature, literary fiction, and a lot of the books that you publish are books that were written first in some language other than English, and you have made available in translation. Mm-hmm. And questions, comments, welcome. We're talking about ebooks. Maybe you want to tell us about your experience. And we have several callers ready to go. We'll get to them in order they came in, which means line one is first in Champaign.
Good morning.
Yes.
Ebooks really are here to stay, and I think your remarks about the word searches are spot on. Page numbers really are becoming irrelevant. In fact, they always have been to some extent because different publications would have the same material on different pages. So you just go right for you zero in on the text that you're interested in. I am one who has had the good fortune to have lunch with a couple of gentlemen who really are pioneers in this. And I'm somewhere Project Gutenberg needs to be mentioned, but that was developed by a U of I student named Michael Hart 40 years ago, or at least he started on it 40 years ago. And there's a man named Greg Newby who's now up in Alaska, and he's managing it from there. But they decided to concentrate on the public domain. Basically the classics, everything that's past copyright. And you can still get that at gutenberg.org. And the last time I had lunch with Michael, he was working on coming up with an application for the iPhone. So there are just all sorts of ways to do this. You don't pay for that. And I'm a little surprised not to be hearing Michael on your program, but maybe some of you folks can have something to say about that. And I'll listen to your remarks offline.
Okay, thanks. Well, it was really Project Gutenberg that I had in mind. Maybe I should have mentioned it by name. The idea that's going back some time. Mm-hmm. There had been people who had this idea that making This was a way to make books available to people. Mm-hmm. And what they were doing was they were taking books that indeed were in the public domain, scanning them, and then if you had a computer, you had internet access, you could have that book and you could read it on your computer. I think still, though, the big jump has been just having an easier, portable, pocket size, if you can stand to read books on your smartphone, device to be able to use that. I mean, it took a while for the hardware to catch up with the availability of text, but there is this wide availability of text, and there are libraries are making books available that way. There are more and more libraries online, so it is
for public domain. It's great.
It is not just about buying and selling, but in a larger way, it actually is about access to books.
I mean, there is that trade off. It's great that everybody can, with a click, get Treasure Island. You know. On the other hand, I remember that wonderful edition of Treasure Island they had with those beautiful color plated illustrations and so forth, and somehow the heft of the book added to the heft of the reading experience.
Yeah.
You don't have that with any book, so there are always going to be trade-offs. And I think for that reason, though I think that in many ways, not always, but in many ways, an e-book is an improvement over a paper book, there are other things about paper books that can never really quite be replicated, and so they're going to continue to exist in the same way that we have LPs and we have CDs and we have downloads. You know, I mean, it's going to be that way for a while, I think. Yeah. You know, the thing that I am not crazy about, and I never had this before until my latest book was published last year, and I found that I'm being pirated a lot, and that really makes me mad. I mean, all of you people out there, you stealing books, you're thieves, you're damn thieves. Sorry, but that's just the way I feel about it. And I think that's a real problem. And it's especially a problem because while it really altered illegal downloading of songs, it really altered things for musicians. Musicians can go on tour and make some money. I don't think that writers are going to be able to go on tour and make some money. So if you're taking royalties away from writers, you're basically, not only are you taking away their bread and butter from the book they just wrote, but official sales determine who's going to publish you next time and what kind of an advance you get next time. So if half or more of your readers are reading your book illegally, that they're basically making it extremely difficult for you to ever get published again. And, you know, I don't think people who do that downloading think about it, or maybe if they do, they don't care. But they're really, you know, they think they're hurting the publisher and they're, you know, it's a little being rebellious or whatever, but they're hurting writers. They're really hurting writers. And I don't understand the illegal downloading of books. I honestly don't.
Yeah, no, I think the piracy issue is, like e-books, the piracy issue is here to stay.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that it's just as it is with the music industry. Well, with the idea that we'll have in the future some kind of combination of print and e-books, there's actually another issue at work in the publishing industry that is probably not as talked about as e-books are, simply because it's not as – you have to understand the publishing industry a little bit to really get into it, but that's print on demand, which is a technology that allows a book to be printed immediately instead of – normally the way it works in the publishing industry is we as publishers, you know, we acquire a book, we edit it, we put it together, then we send it to a printing house and they print up however many copies we order, and those get shipped to a warehouse and they get stored, and there's a whole infrastructure to the publishing industry. Print on demand is means that there's a machine and you can walk into a bookstore and say, I want this book, and they can print it right there. Mm-hmm. It's essentially they have ebook files and they print them out for you.
Solves the problem of warehousing too.
It solves the problem of warehousing, but it's a dramatic change for the publishing industry, and it has the potential actually of kind of destabilizing the entire publishing industry, because it means that any publisher, any author can publish directly with Amazon. Mm-hmm. And Amazon can print the book out if you want a paper copy, or can sell the electronic. And so then we actually, I think, are in danger of a kind of a monopolistic situation.
Yeah. Well, this again, I promise we got callers when we get to, but here you've raised three or four different issues that I think are really interesting, at least. And that is, you know, I think that actually people have made the argument that, and I'm not sure if they were just arguing from an environmental perspective, but they're making the argument that no book should ever be printed until it is sold, till there's actually a buyer for the book, so that you don't end up printing books that maybe nobody ever wants, and then you know what happens to them. But so we have this viable model. So you can either have an ebook that never gets printed, or if you want to have a printed copy, you can order one and have it printed for you. But that does raise questions about all. That's a big change in the way that books have been produced and distributed and sold. Mm-hmm. And you know, is that good or bad for publishers?
It's an enormous change, and I would say that by and large, it's good.
In terms of royalties, doesn't it make it easier in some sense?
It's not so much an issue of royalties. I mean, the reason people are still doing what they call offset printing, which is where you print a large number of books and warehouse them, it's still cheaper and it's still better quality. Print on demand has been around for 15 years, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was involved with print on demand projects 12 years ago, and the quality's gotten much, much better. And you're seeing a lot more, you know, original print on demand books. It's still more cost effective if a book is going to sell, you know, a certain number of copies to do an offset printing. Yeah. The other thing about that is, you know, if you think about how the book selling industry works, not just the publishing industry, but like bookstores, you know, you need to have books out there on the shelf.
Yeah.
If you're going to follow the logic that a book shouldn't be printed until it's bought, then basically you just put all of the bookstores in the country out of business, unless what they're having is a little cardboard card that you bring up to the front desk and then they print out the book for you. Which I'm not saying is a bad thing. I'm not saying that wouldn't be a viable model, and I think that's probably where we're headed.
Yeah.
But it's not where we're at. And so at the moment, it's causing a lot of havoc in the book publishing industry and the book selling industry as all these changes come about, because these changes open all kinds of doors of possibility for doing things more effectively, reaching more people. But at the same time, these technological changes open the door to monopoly and control of a very small number of people controlling a much larger portion of the market.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another aspect of this that I think in terms of just publishing changes is maybe worth talking about, though it's not necessarily about ebooks, which is the fact that and the National Book Critics Circle organization was very upset about this for years, is the fact that a number of newspapers and magazines of note stopped publishing book reviews. Mm-hmm. And so what happened, you know? Well, a proliferation of literary websites on the web that are fantastic. I mean, really fantastic. In fact, I would have to say that of the 100 books that I have on my iPad with my Kindle app and my iBooks, I would say that about 90 of those at least I learned about first from a website, not the New York Times Book Review or any other traditional outlet, but literally from, you know, scrolling around various websites that I trust and going back to them, because when I then download my book and I read it and I go, wow, that was a really good recommendation. And I think that's changing publishing a lot too. Mm-hmm. New York Times is no longer the gatekeeper of who's going to have a successful book and who doesn't. I mean, it's nice to be in there, but frankly, I don't even read the thing pretty much anymore because it seems more like an organ of the major publishers, and it's not really nearly as important as it used to be.
We are already at the midpoint here. We have some callers, other ones. Let's go next to Bloomington, line number 2, Bloomington, Illinois. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Just wanted to comment, courtesy of, I have an iPad, though strangely enough, I read more Kindle books on it than iBooks, but I probably, for me, the big change has been, or big improvement has been, I've probably read more novels this year because of the portability of the device, because I travel a lot on business, than I probably read in the last 10 years, quite frankly.
I have the same experience.
And the other thing, reflecting back on the comment on the Gutenberg project, there's on iBooks and I think Kindle as well, there is a whole bunch of those books available that way. My wife has a favorite author from college days called James H. Schmidt in science fiction, and his books are pretty much out of print, but I was able to gather a bunch of them, read them, and have something to talk to my wife about. So that sort of instantaneous access, or if a friend suggests something, I can literally upload it right there and then and have a book they suggested in an immediate conversation. So that's what it's done for me.
You know, I mean, there are lots and lots of different stories like that. I like to read a lot of different books at the same time. And in the past, if I wanted to walk around, I'd have to carry like four or five books with me, which of course I wasn't going to do. So I would have to pick which one I was going to take around with me as I did my perambulations for the day. And maybe that turned out not to be the book I really wanted to read that day. Now, with a whole library of books on my iPad, I walk around with my iPad and I'm reading five different books at the same time, and I can choose anytime I want which book I'm going to read at that moment. And, you know, that's just the way I am, you know.
Oh, I've gone through the same experience. I'm plowing through Stieg Larsson's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series. At the same time, I'm reading an old anthology called Harlan Ellison's Watching on Film Criticism and everything, and articles on computer tech, and I can slip and slide through back and forth to anything I want. And that's another advantage. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thank you very much. Thanks for the call. Hey. Let's go on to another caller. This is somebody in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I am a book person. I've always been a book person, and I expect to be a book person to my very last day. But I consider my Nook a means of access to books. And the accessibility is so important. I get interested in an author. Mm-hmm. I can get it almost immediately. It is also most excellent for newspapers. If you hear about an article in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and you're not near a newsstand, bloop, you can make a subscription, either for just that day or continuing. So it's very, very useful. It's my portable book library with newspaper and magazine accessibility. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, that's indeed a point I think a lot of people have made, that people are not just using it to read books.
Right. And I think I should have said that even though I personally don't have an e-reader, we have had all of our books offered as e-books for the last 3 years. It's important to me. We are now, just in the past year, starting to see the numbers go up a little bit in terms of the percentages. Mm-hmm. But one thing I noticed that's actually quite interesting is that it opens up the realm of impulse buying.
Yes.
In the book world.
And in a way that it hadn't.
Yeah. Because in the past, you know, you'd hear about it, you'd at least have to click over to one of the online retailers, you know, and then have the book shipped to you.
Mm-hmm.
And now you hear about something, and in that moment when you're interested in it, you can go and usually the online articles, the online reviews that we get will have a book click right there. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually seeing more of that sort of buying, which is from a book selling perspective is interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, if you're looking at a book that's $9.99 instead of $25, it's worth it to take the risk, though I would note that on the Kindle and I suppose the Nook and certainly on the iBook, you can get a sample for a first chapter before you put any money down. So you can look and see, well, oh, I really like this, or, whew, man, dodged a bullet there. I'm never going to read that book. And so, you know, I tend not to do that. I think, you know, I don't gamble except for buying books or things like that or even music. You know, I figure, well, it sounds good. I'm going to take a chance, you know.
Well, what do you – I wonder just on this issue of price. I think that I have read some people still sort of grumbling that they somehow think that e-books are too expensive, that because you don't have the expense of printing it, you don't have the expense of the paper, is somehow they should be a lot less expensive than the paper.
See, the problem, there's a lot of problems with that reasoning.
Yeah.
And I think that reasoning is actually going to hurt the publishing industry pretty considerably. Well, one of the problems is that, people don't understand how publishing works, but the actual cost of printing, sure, but the cost of printing a book, an e-book, is low right now because the cost of creating the book as a book all went into making the paper book in the first place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the vast majority of our costs, and we're a nonprofit organization, so we actually rely on, because we do a lot of literary translation, which is a tough sell. So we're a nonprofit, and we actually make about half of our income comes from donations. The vast majority of the economic resources that we expend are on the labor. Of creating a really viable book. I mean, there's a lot of labor, particularly tied into getting books translated, well translated and edited. But then there's also marketing books, and there's there's all these aspects that people don't think about. They think about how a book, you know, they have access to all of these different books. Well, that's great, but if the structure for publishing, you know, is massively disrupted, then how are you going to hear about those books anymore?
Yeah.
I mean, I could conceive of a day when Amazon's the major seller and they're also the major publisher, and that people just publish their books directly on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And the way that you hear about it is that an author is given a series of packages that they can purchase for marketing their book. And the person who pays the most gets their voice out the most.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that literature for me is about diversity. It's about having the opportunity to reach out and hear about as many different perspectives as possible. And I think that that in that kind of model, what we're in danger of losing in literature is that kind of diverse.
And Amazon has shown itself in the past to be pretty creepy every once in a while, you know, taking people's books away from their devices without telling them and so forth, and all kinds of disputes. That thing is lit up. Should we talk to some?
Well, I tell you what, we'll do that. We'll talk to some more callers. We'll talk with our guest here in a moment, Philip Graham and Martin Riker. We're talking about e-books. First, though, let's take a short break. This is Focus.
After abruptly departing MSNBC in January, Keith Olbermann returns to broadcasting later this month with a new version of Countdown on the current TV network. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Keith Olbermann about why he left MSNBC and about his plans for the new show. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
It costs about $15 to broadcast a minute of programming on WILL. Programs like Morning Edition, Focus, and Classic Mornings are made possible by listeners who give a few minutes of financial support for their favorite program. You can help WILL reach its membership goal of $2.1 million by June 30th when you contribute a few of your minutes of financial support at willpledge.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here during the week. We have a number of different topics. Let me just mention real quick. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, it's our monthly show on diet and nutrition. Susan Kundrat's the guest. Celeste Gwynn will host the show. Also, she'll be hosting hour two. She'll be talking with two anthropologists, Ellen Steinberg and Jack Prost, about the book From the Jewish Heartland, Two Centuries of Midwest Foodways. And then on Thursday, we'll talk about severe weather. This is the worst season for tornadoes that we've seen in something like 50 years, just about in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that and why it is that meteorologists really don't quite understand why that is. The guest will be Grady Dixon. He's an assistant professor of meteorology and climatology at Mississippi State University. If you'd like to find out what we're doing on the program this week, next week, you can go to our website. That way you can also catch up on past programs you might have missed first time around, willill.illinois.edu. In this hour, we have two guests. Philip Graham is professor of English and creative writing at the University of Illinois, has published fiction, poetry, nonfiction. And Martin Riker is also here. He is associate director of the Dahlke Archive Press, which started out in the early 80s in Chicago, now here is on the campus of the University of Illinois. They specialize in literary fiction, also in translations. Questions, comments are welcome. We're talking about e-books, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we do have a number of callers, so why don't we go ahead and talk with some more folks. And someone on a cell phone here next, line four. Hello.
Howdy.
Yes.
I'd like to follow up on the first two callers and mention that the first e-book was put online right down the street from where you are. If you go out on the Goodwin and turn left and go past Stoughton and Springfield, the very first building facing onto Goodwin is the Materials Research Lab, and that's where Project Gutenberg was started. Maybe someday they'll put up a brass plaque. And that was 4th of July 40 years ago. And they'll be having a big celebration at a site called worldebookfair.org from July 4th to August 4th. And they already have about 6 2/3 million books on that portal. And possibly by the time they get done, because they're adding about 1,000 a day, they might get up to 7 million. That's only open 1 month a year. but Gutenberg.org, Gutenberg.cc, archive.org are all open all year round, where you can go down and buy one of these little terabyte drives or terabyte and a half drives that put in your pocket, and you can literally fill up the whole drive with millions of books and carry your own massive library with you. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. That is just it's sort of mind-bogglingly cool, actually. The idea that you could do such a thing, and it's one of those things that people, I'm sure, for a long time imagined or dreamed of, and said, "Well, you know, one of these days, such a thing would be possible." And well. That day is here.
You know, Captain Picard on the Star Trek Enterprise, I Googled this, man. It looks like he's reading a Kindle. It really does. He had some kind of electronic book, and it looks very – I think they designed it based on the Star Trek thing, but it looks eerily similar to what people are reading from now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the next thing is – so we had to figure out how to download them straight into our brains.
There'll be a USB
port. That happens. USB port right behind ear.
Thank you.
I'm not ready for that. USB key right in there. Let's go to line one. Robinson is next. Hello.
Hello, David.
Yes, hi.
I am an old man, and thus my comments are probably not going to bear much weight. I do not have an e-book reader. But Philip's comment about looking up the definition of a word like commission brings to mind that publishers, even the most prestigious nowadays, no longer appear to employ proofreaders or editors. They come out with homonyms misspelled and incorrect words that sound vaguely like the one they meant. Now, Philip, when you look up the definition, as you commented you did, does it give the dictionary definition?
It's the American Oxford Dictionary, and it immediately, when you press a word, a window comes up with the definition and everything. You know, all the if it can be used as a verb or a noun, and what the origin is, and so forth. It's a pretty comprehensive way of looking at the word.
Well, in that case, I had a problem with an English historical author who misused the word mantel, M-A-N-T-E-L, which is the shelf over a fireplace, and mantle, M-A-N-T-L-E, which in his case was a gauzy fabric over a gas jet to increase the light. And he used mantle, the fireplace shelf, when he shouldn't have, and the dictionary is going to give that definition, and the
That would be bad.
reader is going to be very much confused.
Yeah, or figure out what you did, which was that this can't be right. It must be misspelled, you know.
Okay, well, thanks for letting me put in my two bits.
Thanks.
Well, one thing I'll say about that is actually that caller is illustrating something that I was saying before about the hidden costs of publishing. There's costs to making a book well. And you can go online and find all kinds of free editions of public domain books that just look like garbage, you know. If we don't care about whether a book is made well, then frankly we don't need publishers anymore. And that might be the world we're moving toward. But the role of the publisher is to find, you know, books you wouldn't know about and to make them well and to publish them well and to market them well. And I think, for instance, cutting back on proofreaders, I don't know if the world is quite as drastic in terms of proofreaders as the caller is suggesting. But that is the kind of thing, that's the kind of cost that readers don't usually think about when they think about what it goes into making a book.
Yeah. I have to say, having gone through the process that you were just described about a year and a half ago for my latest book, a book about Lisbon, and now I'm starting to go through that same thing with a book about Africa that I co-wrote with my wife, a second volume of an African memoir. I could just say, you know, we turned in the manuscript, our editor took a look at it, had some suggestions, we did a little more work on it, sent it out to readers, outside readers, they had some comments, we did a little more work on it. Now it's about to go to copy editing. After we do that, we'll probably make a few more changes because I'm a real big reviser. Then we'll go to the galleys and so forth. Then we'll be dealing with the publicity people. There's a wonderful guy at my press who's a terrific publicist. And, I mean, it's a long process with a lot of extremely professional people who actually get paid money to do their jobs so that when the book comes out, the cover looks beautiful and the typeface looks beautiful. Everything looks great. And that's going to be terrible if something that like that is lost. Because if you can just, you know, type up any old thing and print it out and call it a book, it's not really quite going to be there. It's the sense of, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, I think in some ways it takes a publishing house to publish a book. You can't just do it on your own.
Well,
you know?
That's I think people have written about the ebook, and one of the positives they would argue is that it makes it now very easy to self-publish.
Yeah.
And so one might say, well, that's great. Then that will mean that books will be published that would not have been published before, and maybe some of those are good books. But if there are no publishers, if there are no editors, if there are no people to do that kind of work that you've talked about, then what have we lost?
I mean, you know, we got one letter from an outside reader that was fabulous, another one that had some real complaints. And we were like, first, grumble, 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 you know? And then we're like, this person really saved us. You know, there's some things we didn't see that we couldn't have seen because we were so close to the material. Sure. Thank God, you know? And that's just a wonderful process. And I don't think that it can be substituted easily.
We have maybe about 10 minutes. We have some other callers. Let's just keep going here. We'll go to line two. This is Savoy. Hello.
Hello. I have a Kindle that I really like, and one of the things I do is go to magazines and newspapers and then copy and paste so that I can carry the articles around inside of it. My question, though, is if you like an author and you want to support the author, what is better for them, royalties and credit, whatever, if you buy it from a bookstore in a volume or if you buy it via electronic?
I think that's a really good question because of the word better. the authors at this point make higher royalties off of ebooks by and large. But that's what I would say the short-term gain is for the author. But that's because a lot of the costs of creating the book are still being folded into the creation of the paper book. Yeah. So it's better. Is it better for authors if they make more money now, but the publishers suffer? I don't know. That's a question to be debated. I think that, well, honestly, I think we're at the verge of a massive change in how all of this stuff is done, where we're in the middle of it. And I think some things are definitely going to be better, and some things are probably almost definitely going to be worse in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you think about it, the old model of hardback first and then paperback, and it was almost always that you would have to sell a certain amount of hardbacks to be guaranteed a paperback edition. And then when the paperback came out, it would almost always, hopefully, but I would say in general, would sell more copies than the hardback because it was a less expensive edition. Yeah. Now we have ebooks that are even less expensive than paperbacks right now. And so, yes, you get more royalties on an ebook if you're an author, but you're getting it's a smaller sale price. On the other hand, you can talk about it in terms of volume, and Martin had mentioned the thing about impulse buying and so forth. I mean, you probably have the potential, especially down the line, of selling far more books in an e-edition because it's so inexpensive. In fact, there are some people out there who have self-published and sell their books for $1 or $2 who've made hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, they'll write a kind of a vampire-ish, genre-y kind of a book, and people, you know, who read those kinds of books just love to get more and more of them, and so they buy them, and what's wrong about a $2 book? And all of a sudden, if you've got 10,000 people buying your book in a month, you're making some good change there. So, the models are changing like crazy.
Yeah, actually, let me back up a step on what I said earlier, because in a lot of cases, actually, publishers are doing just as well on ebooks as they are on paper in terms of the percentage of income per unit sold, as we say. It is causing changes in the whole industry, because the industry also involves wholesalers and warehousers and printing houses. Mm. And, of course, printing houses aren't doing too well with e-books. But so it's just it's basically it's a very volatile time. But in answer to your question, probably e-books.
All right, thank you.
I'm just Philip. You're referring to there's a woman named Amanda Hocking.
Yes, that's right.
Amanda Hocking.
I forgot her name.
She lives in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. She wrote these books that were young adult supernatural fiction. She mm-hmm. couldn't get anybody to publish them, so she decided to publish them herself. She did. She published them herself as e-books and reportedly made $1 million selling her books, and just recently signed up with St. Martin's Press.
Yeah, right, to do
and got a $2 million advance.
I know. So, you know, it's a Wild West, folks.
Well,
yeah,
that's what, exactly so. I mean, exactly so. Now, conversely, there's another guy, Barry Eisler, who is mm-hmm. well known as a thriller writer, who left St. Martin's right at the same time mm-hmm. Amanda Hocking came
to
in
do his own.
To publish himself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know how as a writer, you think about the idea of self-publishing.
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm finishing up a novel right now this summer. I've got a book coming out in the spring. I've got a couple books that I'm working on that are right behind that. I'm not sure which book of mine is going to be the first book that's only published as an ebook. You know?
Yeah.
And when it comes down to that, then there is the issue of do you do it yourself or do you do it with a publisher? Now, I like the idea of having a group of people around me that are, you know, I'm really big on checks and balances. I think it works in government. I think it works in nature. I think it works in pretty much every relationships, you know.
Yeah.
And I think there's no reason why it shouldn't work in publishing. And so I'm really nervous whenever I'm out on a limb by myself because I know how fallible I am, you know, as a writer, as a person, as an everything. So I like the sense of an organization that's helping put something out. But again, as Martin says, things are changing so much. I honestly don't know what's going to happen 5 years from now. I don't think anybody has the slightest idea what publishing is going to look like 5 years from now.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because you hear the success stories with self-publishing, and I would like to get a statistic on how many non-success stories.
Sure.
But yeah. I think, I think that to the extent that an author can fulfill all the things that a publisher does, they probably are better off self-publishing. I mean, if they are effective as a self-promoter, for instance,
that's right.
Then they can do a better job for themselves. Mm-hmm. I think it's a problem that you create an environment in which an author has to be a person who promotes themselves, because mm-hmm. not all authors are valuable, you know, who have something to say necessarily are very good at promoting or very inclined mm-hmm. toward promoting themselves. Or the other option would be you create an environment where people have to pay to promote themselves, which again gets back to what I was saying. Like you could have this world where mm-hmm. Amazon gives you your packages to choose from.
Yeah. Take it or leave it. Yeah.
But I think that some of that, many of those things that publishers traditionally do are under scrutiny now in terms of is this something that the author can do themselves, or is this something that Amazon can do for them, or mm-hmm. Google, because that's the other big player in all this.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that I read about Amanda Hocking was that in her decision to actually go with a publisher, go with St. Martin's, she sort of said, I just want to write. I just want to concentrate on writing.
Yeah.
So I could see that then she would say, well, I'll leave this other stuff. I'll leave
the
marketing.
The
And she just wanted to write books.
Yeah.
We have a couple of minutes left, at least some other callers. We'll get in as many as we can and go next to Champaign and line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've been involved in information privacy for about 40 years, and I had an interesting experience recently. I bought a book titled Privacy in Context. I'm sorry, I can't remember the author's name. I read a loaned copy and was interested in having a private copy. Searched for that and eventually wound up with the publisher and discovered there was no way to buy a book anonymously. The idea of going to a bookstore and plunking down cash for a book that you took away and that nobody knew the book you were reading seems to be maybe not impossible, but very difficult. And I'd have to limit that to only these large centralized retailing channels.
Yeah.
A because I, as much as I'm aware, Gutenberg, you can download books anonymously.
Hmm.
And just any comments about privacy and electronic publishing?
I would say welcome to the world of Twitter and Facebook, you know. And for everybody out there, I have some advice. Never send any pictures of yourself over Twitter, you know. I mean, that's the world we're in. That's the world we're in. When I've lived in a small villages in West Africa for years, and the thing about my experience there, starting in 1979, was that there was no privacy. That the culture had no word for privacy. It was very, very social, and you could almost never have private time. And that's just the way that culture worked. And there was always a kind of a relief, on some level, to come back to the United States and feel like things were a little different. Not the same anymore. I think there's less privacy in the United States now than there is in an African village.
Yeah, this gets to the much bigger issue, I think, at hand, which is the supposed shift of the nature of reading from being a private activity, an activity of solitude and solitary contemplation, to a sort of social activity,
yeah.
and a
yeah.
public one. And I think that's a huge issue that we could easily do a separate program on. But I will say that I think that, and this isn't exactly what the caller was talking about, but I do think that it's a major issue. A lot of the people, ebooks do not necessarily push us towards a more social model of reading. In other words, a model where reading is interactive, where we are commenting on each other's texts and so forth. It doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily lead to that, but it certainly lends itself to it in a way that a print book doesn't.
Yeah.
It opens up the possibilities for it, and I think that the industry has been pushing a sort of more social model of reading, which for me is the biggest problem. I don't have problems with ebooks, but I do have a bit of a problem with the idea of a social model of reading, because we live in a very social world, and one of the only places where we find space for solitary contemplation is in reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hate to lose that. I'm really worried that as our world becomes much more interactive and public, that we're going to lose that space and maybe not even notice yeah. as it slipped away.
I'm really sorry to say we're going to have to just call a halt to the conversation here with a couple of callers we can't include, with so much more that we could say.
I selfishly say have us back. We haven't even talked about children's e-books, which are quite amazing and so forth, you know?
Well, we could probably find at least a few other things to talk about
yeah.
for the moment, however.
No, I mean, bring us back later sometime.
All right. Yeah. Philip Graham, professor of English and creative writing at the University of Illinois. Go down to the bookstore and you can find some of his work. Or if you'd like to go to...
Download my book.
Yeah, download
it's available on the
that.
Kindle
but
and the
don't
Nook.
Pirate
on,
yeah.
But don't
yes,
pirate
but
it.
Make sure you pay for it. And also Philip Martin Riker. He's associate director at Dahlke Archive Press. They have a lot of very interesting and unusual books, and particularly books. They're known for publishing books in English that were not written in that language.
Right.
So a lot of literature and translation. So it's good work that they're doing. And thank you both very much for
thank
being
you.
Here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.